Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 9th, 2003. Today's session is Who Did the Israelites Think They Were? Session 2 of Afroasiatic Roots of the Old Testament, presented by Peter Nash. Number NAP 2003-02. Let's listen in.
So, Vernon Carroll, welcome. I'm going to just spend a couple minutes talking briefly about what we said yesterday for those who weren't able to be here or chose not to be. I got you anyway. Just to put us all on the same track. Talked yesterday about how in the late Enlightenment, physical anthropology developed as a natural science under the care of Hans Blumenbach at Göttingen University. And he is the first academic to actually write about human races in a non-theological way. Until then, it's been pretty much the separation between the university and theology weren't all that great. Göttingen was the first university in Europe where we could study anything without studying theology. If you want to study medicine, you also have to study theology. We would love that if we could get that in the seminaries today, but I don't think it's going to come back. Or even in the departments of religion. And his colleague, Johann David Michaelis, in the School of Theology, teaching Old Testament, teaching anthropology, took some of the physical anthropology stuff that he had done and developed the developing use of social anthropology or cultural anthropology, as we usually say in the United States, to the study of the Old Testament and the ancient tradition. And I think that made for a mess that brought some ideas, well, especially this idea of distinct human races, gave it a scientific footing, which if you watch the church and the development of theology for a while, you understand that there's a dialogue and a competition. And we don't really know where we fit, and sometimes things get proven scientifically, and then that is really good for our theological process. And sometimes things get proven or proved, I can't remember which is the best place to come in, scientifically, and then it's bad for theology, and we have a love-hate relationship with physical sciences. But what happened in my opinion with the idea that there are distinct human races is it lent credence to some of the religious racism that had been prevalent for some time, at least since the Inquisition, when it was when we noted most prominently in Western civilization, with the expulsion of the Muslims and the Jews from Spain, forced conversions and so on, and that's the imposition of a series of rules about who could become a Christian, who was really a Christian, and who decided, and then how long it would take for that person who had converted, often under force, to enter into a position of confidence within the society. We also have to remember that societies back then didn't distinguish much, that there was no separation of church and state, no separation of synagogue and state, no separation of mosque and state. Your identity up until about the 15th century was pretty much tied into your community's faith stance, whatever it might be. As we remember, those of us who are Lutherans or Catholic, in Germany, you had to be either Lutheran or Catholic. And in some small places, you had a choice to be Reformed, but it was Protestant or Catholic or nothing. You move from one to another. One of the first questions was, what was the faith back there? Are you faithful to the Pope or not? Are you part of the Reformation or not? And people had to go from one Reformation spot to another, or from one Catholic spot to another. And those distinctions are still pretty strong regionally in Germany until today. Now let's talk about Afro-Asiatic languages and cultures. I put a question mark here today because I remember a conversation that I had with my linguistic mentor, Gene Gregg, who was the Semitic or the Afro-Asiatic linguist at the University of Chicago. He said, we're still doing the research. We can't say for sure if language follows culture. English language, for example, is going everywhere in the world, but English culture, or American culture more specifically, hasn't gone everywhere. In the same way during the English, the British Empire, the language went everywhere. Some parts of the culture went, not all of the culture, parts of the culture were inserted into the many parts of the British Empire. In the current American Empire, we're seeing the same thing. The language goes, the Walkman goes, the Game Boy goes, but not, they don't want everything that we've got. So how much the culture's moved and interlaced is something that I freely admit is open to question. But Gene also lists the language on the home page of the page that deals with the Afro-Asiatic lexicon that Gene and his graduate students are working on. Talks about Hamitic languages, Semitic languages, Omotic languages, and even some Bantu languages that fall into this family. So it's a little broader. I was remembering last night that it's a little broader than I presented yesterday. It says, around Lake Chad in West Africa, about 10,000 years before present, these languages sprung up and began to migrate east to the Great Rift Valley. This is a huge valley that runs all the way up through Africa and over into the Middle East, which the Jordan Valley is part of, and went all the way over to Mesopotamia and down into the foothills of Mount Kilimanjaro. So that's a huge area where these languages, and I think, to some extent, these cultures were flowing back and forth. Interestingly enough for me, one of the hot areas of research in Proverbs is how the biblical Proverbs are parallel to many Proverbs in many Bantu cultures. Bantu is a language group, not as that South African derogatory term for Africans, that old South African derogatory term for black Africans, but as a language, a linguistic group that linguists work with. So a little review and expansion of what we talked about yesterday. I brought the Bibles in here with Jonathan Price's help. If you don't have a Bible nearby, I'm going to ask you to grab a Bible.
Did you grab the new one? Sorry.
And if you've already got a Bible, let's already turn to Genesis 10. That's in the very beginning of the Bible.
Yes.
Could I ask a question?
Sure, but I might not answer it. I might not know.
Could you, I actually know what the Bantu languages are, and I think I know what the Semitic languages are, but I don't know what the Hamitic and Omotic.
The Hamitic languages are the old, pretty much the old languages, the ancient languages of Northern Africa. They include the Egyptian, and some people would put the Berber languages there, other people would put them in the Semitic family. So the Hamitic family is not too clear, except in the case of Egyptian and its successor languages. The Egyptian, we usually think about as hieroglyphics, but it had it was Egyptian, then Hieratic, Demotic, and Hieratic. I think that's the other. Basically, time progressions, the style of writing and so on. Omotic languages is another group of languages in Central Africa, if I remember correctly, that gets out of my... I actually work as a specialist in one little part of the Semitic languages. I had to work with Gene because he was the only other one beside my advisor who read this stuff there. Okay. I think I'm right about that, but if somebody knows for sure, we'll take correction. So Genesis 10. This is the story that follows immediately on the story of the flood and the curse of an interesting story that is often used in a racialized way about the curse of the Canaanites What I'm interested in today is just how the Israelites, in their founding story or founding myth, talked about their understanding of the world and who their neighbors were. So if we look at, and I'm especially interested today in the family of Ham, the Hamitic languages and Hamitic cultures, who they listed there. So if someone would read in a loud, clear voice, 6 through 14.
And the sons of Ham, Cush, and Mizraim, and Phut, and Canaan. And the sons of Cush, Seba, and Havilah, and Sabta, and Ra'amah, and Sabticha, and the sons of Ra'amah, Sheba, and Dedan. And Cush begat Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter, before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Achad, and Calneh, in the land of Shinar. Keep going? Oh, sorry. 14, okay. Out of that land went forth Asher, and builded Nineveh, and the city Rehoboth, and Calah. And Resen between Nineveh and Calah, the same is a great city. And Mizraim and begot Ludim, and Anaimim, and Lahabim, and Naphtuhim, and Pathrusim, and Kasluhim, out of whom came Philistim. That's the important one. And Kaphtorim.
So if anybody's looking for names for your cottage or your children, Table of Nations is the place to go.
This is the Gideon version.
Egypt. Yeah, I put some things up here. Mitzrayim is Egypt. It's if you went to Cairo today, there's a great story from back when. Which James Bond movie was filmed in Cairo? Starts in Cairo. It's not that important, but our Arabic professor there told us that when they showed the movie for the first time in Cairo, nobody believed that it was actually in Cairo until they saw some of the classic scenes, like the part of this film, the pyramids with the great light show. But there was a specific mosque that they really didn't. Everybody yelled, "The mosque," which is the current, the modern Arabic way of saying Matsrin, Mitzrayim. That's the Hebrew. Masr means Cairo and Egypt. So they recognize it there. Put, I believe, is Libya. Cush is Ethiopia, which is something we need to talk about. All of these, I said yesterday, I don't want you to think I'm taking this stuff literally, but literarily. And there are some problems already in this story, or in this narrative of who is who. Because Assyria comes in there, and Assyria should not, by our divisions, be among the Hamitic peoples, but among the Semitic peoples. That's one problem. And then the Philistines, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, nobody knows who they really were. They came off the seas in the 13th century BC. So they shouldn't be Hamitic. So there's a problem. There are problems with what I'm about to say, but bear with me and you can chew me up later, but let's see if we can get there first. This is a picture of how they saw their world. They saw this first bunch is most important to me. Mitzrayim, Put, Cush, Canaan. This bunch is really cool because they fit together quite nicely. They're all in northeast Africa. I take that to mean that the ancient Israelites saw something of in common with these people and saw them as coming from the same general region. Another that gets put in there is Canaan, which archaeologically we know had very close cultural ties, very strong dependency on Egypt. So that it may have been a colony, it may have proceeded as a colony of Egypt. But they tuck it into this family line here. Is that relatively clear what I mean to say there? So in this dance that I'm doing with the text, I tried to find out where I've identified these people as, in the perception of the Israelites, Africans or African descendants. These three cases, clearly African, in this case, African descendants. Fair enough? Even if you think it's goofy, it's clear enough.
And they've just been cursed.
Pardon?
Was the curse beforehand for just Canaan? Or for all the descendants of Canaan?
I think it's just for Canaan. You can take a look back there on the page before, but that's one of the rough pieces there about the curse of Ham as it was interpreted by the racialist slave traders. They made it the curse of Ham, but the curse is actually specifically for Canaan, if my memory doesn't come.
That's what it says.
That's what it says, right. Mm-hmm.
And just a word about the curse of Ham, the curse of Canaan. Almost everybody I've ever read accepts without almost any discussion that this is a curse that is there to explain why the Israelites have the right to dominate the Canaanites. This explains why we are culturally, morally, ethically superior to our neighbors whom we are about to annihilate. Sort of like Saddam Hussein. My task today is to try to convince some of you that the Israelites understood themselves to be, like all of us, as I said yesterday, African descendants. But in a world where Africa meant something a little different. Oh, I need to say something. We have all grown up in a society where you say Africa, and you think, well, many of us think poverty, corruption, famine, warfare, illiteracy, and anything else? And leave anything out of the general picture of Africa?
Disease.
Mm.
What?
Primitive.
I think it's often thought of as Black South Sahara.
Black South Sahara, and what North Sahara? What North is Sahara?
Maybe Egypt, Morocco, right on here. What don't you think of that as
Muslim? Yeah. Muslim. kind of a late distinction. Islam is only, 1,400 years old. Anybody taking a good look at the pictures of the terrorists that our government has taken into custody? Don't a lot of them look like the black guys you see hanging out on the corners in Chicago, Chicago and Washington and Seattle and Los Angeles? And take a look at how many of these guys, if they were in the States, would be African American. So these lines are way more complex than the binary system that we have in the United States, where you're either African American or you're not. A lot of gradation. But one of the points I want to make before we jump into the stories about the genealogies, or the narratives that lead to some of the genealogies that are interesting to me, is the fact that in the ancient world, Africa was a source of everything. Fine gold. The Egyptians were the pinnacle of civilization. The Ethiopians, even in first century Rome, now some people don't like Diodorus of Sicily. They think he's more of a novelist than a historian, but they say that Herodotus is the father of lies, not the father of history now. But then he sometimes is a good historian. And the same thing is true of Diodorus. When they like him, they say that it depends on his sources, and this source, the one that I like, is good. But in these other places where I don't agree with him, well, his sources are not so good. Well, Diodorus of Sicily, who wrote, I think, a dozen volumes about the history of the world back in the first century, a Roman historian, said that the Ethiopians were the first to honor the gods. That these are the people who teach us how to worship God, or the gods in the case of the Romans. Where does he go? He cites 12th century BCE, 12th century BC, Homer, I think from the 15th book of the Iliad, not the Odyssey, where there's a passage that says that Zeus absents himself from Olympus for a month every year to go to Ethiopia. And all of the gods go with him. Why? Because the Ethiopians, who were the first peoples and the first to honor the gods, throw the best parties for the gods. So the ancient idea of Africa, at least this part of Africa, and I would extend it further because of this connection, was much more positive than what we grew up with for all kinds of bad reasons. Clear up? Ancient idea about Africa is different from the modern ideas about Africa. Or ancient ideas about Africa are much different from modern ideas about Africa. Africa for them, ironically, we're coming back around to this, that was the source of all life, where human life began. The Ethiopians, the Dora says, were autochthonous, the only truly autochthonous people. One of the problems that we've had in the 20th century is about some weird idea of purity of race, a thing that has never existed among human beings. And in fact, the people who most cried about this DNA mapping is showing us today are the most miscegenated people in the world. The European bloc is the people who are the most highly mixed. The Asians, they kind of separated off about 70,000 BC. The Africans have an interesting mix, but it's an autochthonous mix because that's where the Homo sapiens who survived came out of. But the Europeans have got a mix of Asians and Africans and everything else, and so, ha ha, Adolf. So, it's kind of a shorter. What is in this group here? Want to say from here over, or if, you know, you can divide yourselves how you want, and so you don't have to separate families and so on. But Numbers 12, 1 through 9. Take a look at that story. Numbers 12, 1 through 9, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or book in the Old Testament. So this middle bunch here would look at Genesis 41, 37 through 52, and see what that story is about. And, you guys get cheated, but this group over here, just take a look at Saul. Oh, this is interesting because of the way the translation is handled. If you look at Psalm 7, verse 1, and make sure you look at the introduction, because the introduction is actually a big part of verse 1, and it's the part that I missed with. Time to go again. What's going on in Numbers 12, 1 through 9?
Miriam and Aaron are angry at Moses because of the Cushite woman he had married. And there's parentheses that say, for he indeed married a Cushite woman.
Yeah, let me just start right. Does everybody read the story the same way? Or what do you hear? What did you all read?
God brings them down because they're criticizing, bad-mouthing Moses for Moses having married a Cushite woman.
Is that what Moses is being criticized for?
They spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married.
Is there anything else going on in this story in these first 9 verses?
There's this whole distinction between that he's not a prophet.
Aaron and Miriam are. Oh, sorry.
It's all right.
I'm on the record. Well, they're kind of jealous because they want to know, is God only speaking through Moses?
Yeah. This is the point here. What is the critic when Miriam is castigated? What is said? Does a Cushite woman come up and when God responds?
No.
What? How does God respond here? What is her problem?
God says, I've talked straight to Moses and the other prophets only in visions and dreams.
Okay, so the broader framework in this story is that they're criticizing Moses. We have a tradition in the Hebrew Bible that Moses, Miriam, and Aaron are three co-equal prophets. If you go to Micah, you'll see that tradition resonates there. It comes up here as in a negative form and a positive form of Micah. And one other place that I've forgotten, and I don't have my laptop with Bible Works on it, so I can't find it real quickly. Send me an email when you get out of here, and I'll find it in August sometime when I have a house again. But this is part of a tradition that has been submerged in the lifting up of Moses as the unique primary prophet of Israel. Right? For generations, we've read this text to understand, and the parentheses here, and is this the new RSV or the RSV? It's amazing to read what has happened with this text. There are exclamation points. Now, I just picked up the Hebrew Bible again. That's kind of a joke, but there is no such thing as an exclamation point in Hebrew. So where did they get that from? Somebody decided, he married a Cushite. He married a Cushite. Oh, one of the things I forgot. The Cushites, Nubians, Ethiopians, two things I forgot. Maybe three, but wait long enough. When I was in grad school in the 80s, they were still teaching that the Cushites and the Nubians were always subordinate to the Egyptians. They taught Egyptology, and so everybody around the Egyptians was subordinate. Starting in the 1960s, with the great UNESCO rescue operation in Abu Simbel, there's been a resurgence of Nubian, Cushite, Ethiopian archaeology, where it's been taken on as its own project, not as an arm of Egyptology. And the whole picture has changed. We now know since the third millennium, since the fourth millennium before Christ, or before the Common Era, however you want to put it, the Nubians and the Cushites, Nubians slash Cushites, because that's sort of a vague distinction there, were the rivals. At times, they were the dominant force in the Nile Valley, and sometimes they were trading partners who worked in cooperation. So this idea that the Egyptians were the great civilization of the Nile Valley, they are the great civilization in terms of monuments, but a lot of the monuments we now know are Ethiopian monuments, Cushitic monuments. The whole 25th dynasty, the dynasty that the Hebrew 8th century prophets talked about, that was the Ethiopian dynasty. The 18th dynasty that I talked about yesterday with King Tut and Nefertiti and Akhenaten, that was another southern African, a southern Nile African, very distinctly African-looking dynasty. And so the picture of Africa as power was more generalized than we grew up with. It's not just Egypt that was the power, and it's not the Egyptian with Yul Brynner and Charlton Heston, but, they were a lot more colorful than the mill and others have represented. So, I think what is happening here, this is something I've stolen, I borrowed from Randy Bailey, who teaches at ITC in Atlanta, who was in and of himself an interesting guy, a black scholar with a Jewish mother. How he escaped being Jewish, I don't know. He went to Brandeis University. And after becoming a social worker, he became a theologian and has been teaching at one of the two black theological centers in the United States. ITC, the Interdenominational Theological Center, is one, and Howard University School of Divinity is the other prominent black divinity school in the United States. And he says, no, we've been reading this backwards for centuries. The point of the Cushite woman is Moses got himself a high-class woman. Yeah. And if you read about the Ethiopians and the Cushites and the Hebrew Bible, you'll see that they're often used as the superlative. Are you not as to me as Ethiopian? You're talking to Israel. As a prize position. It's not dissimilar to that that we see in Theodorus of Sicily. So now there's a problem with this first one, but I've talked about some other problems along with this. Here's one more. There's still a question as to how many wives Moses had. We know about Zipporah, right? But now we've got this unnamed woman in Numbers 12. Some people say it's the same woman. Other people say, no, it's the second wife. If it's the same woman, this lovely map of Africa again, the Red Sea here, Midian would be in this area. Ethiopia could be here. And down as far as here. Recent doctoral dissertation at the Methodist University in São Paulo argues for this being a cultural unit. And there are archaeological and literary reasons for believing that. One that you probably all have heard some wind of is that the Queen of Sheba, be she here or here, the Ethiopian church, the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, a good number of those people trace their roots back to a union between the Queen of Sheba and Solomon in 1 Kings 10. And they believe, those of us who are old enough to remember, and that is the name, Haile Selassie, believe that he was the last descendant of King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. But there are other more substantial artifactual reasons to believe that these two cultures were closely tied, which is in modern-day Yemen and modern-day Ethiopia. But Ethiopia is sort of an ambiguous term that comes from over here in the Horn of Africa and runs down underneath into the Sudan in the ancient world. So if it's the same woman, it's no problem to call this Midianite an Ethiopian. We call the Midianites Ishmaelites at the beginning of the Joseph story. The confusion between Ishmaelites and Midianites, who are the traitors who take Joseph down to Egypt and so on. But if you bear with me, just a creative leap for just a moment. If it's the same woman, Moses has children with this woman, that means some of the Levites are Catholic descendants. So there's number one. Okay? Clear enough what I'm trying to say? Genesis 41:37-52. What happens in that story?
Joseph marries an
Egyptian. Joseph marries an Egyptian. What is her social status?
The daughter of the priest.
Daughter of a high priest. So he gets a religious princess in the deal as he steps up in status from slave to second in command of Egypt. And do they have children?
Yes.
They have two children.
Manasseh and Ephraim.
Manasseh and Ephraim. Ephraim, which often stands in the prophets in place of the name Israel, represented in the north, becomes a very prominent tribe. So, and depending on which counting of the tribes, we either have here two half-tribes to make up one tribe, which makes me one short, or we have two tribes. Sometimes each is counted as a tribe. Once the Levites move out of the lottery for territory, then these become each a tribe rather than a half-tribe. So I'll say that there's two and three, the second and third tribes of Israel, who saw themselves as Afro-descendants. They remember quite proudly their Egyptian heritage, and not only their Egyptian ethnic cultural heritage, but their Egyptian religious heritage. And this is another way of getting at the fact that the religion that we often talk about as so pure in the Old Testament was much more multifaceted than we teach in catechism, or even in seminary in most cases. Any question about this bunch?
Is there any evidence that particular bunch was the leaders of the Golden Calf episode, or is there no That's
yeah, I've not even thought about that. I don't know that for a fact. There's some talk about Ephraim being in his leadership role back in that story. If I'm not mistaken, I honestly don't have details to go. I'll write that down in my notes, and if I steal it, I'll try to remember it.
I'm a Levite, so.
You are?
Yeah.
Well, see, that's why they.
That's why the guys, yeah.
And now, Psalm 7, verse 1. What do we have there?
It refers to Cush as a Benjaminite.
A Shigayon, a song, a lament, a complaint of David with reference to Cush the Benjaminite, and then the body, that's the introduction, and then the psalm starts. So half of verse 1 is introduction to the psalm, and then the actual song starts. Cush the Benjaminite. They had no problem with this concept. Anybody remember who else was a Benjaminite?
Saul.
Saul is the son of who? Son of Kish. And these languages where the vowels are really kind of messy. Some people want to make Cush Kish, and other people want to make Kish Cush. All for their own reasons. There was a large, an extended argument in the 60s and 70s as these sort of crazy ideas began to surface to make sure that nobody confused anybody in the Hebrew Bible with any Africans. Every Cush, almost every Cush, and many of them we know were Africans without any doubt, were transferred over to Mesopotamia to Kish, which is an ancient city mentioned in the Assyrian king list, where kingship came down to earth was the city of Kish. Interesting that in the Israelite tradition, where kingship had its formal beginning was with the son of Kish, or the son of Kish, which could also mean an inhabitant of Kish. If someone was an inhabitant of Jerusalem, he was a Ben, son of Jerusalem. So that there are some problems there as well, but the received text is Cush, and there are enough other places where the Cushites are prominently mentioned, and there's no possibility of mistaking them for Kishites that we can. I'm going to go ahead with a fairly tranquil state saying that the Benjaminites understood themselves to be at least in part Afro descent, have Cushite heritage. Any questions?
Well, let me just be clear, because Benjamin was Rachel's son, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And Rachel was... Are you saying Rachel was a Cushite?
No, I'm saying that at some point in the many movements,
between
Cushites entered into the tribe of Benjamin.
I gotcha. Okay.
Without any problem. Okay. But that raises another interesting point. In terms of how we're going to talk about Afro descendants and African culture in Israel, another part of the founding myth of Israel is that they spent 400 years in Egypt. Right? If you spend 400 years, if your family spends 400 years someplace, there's going to be some mixing. No, it's just a fact. It's just a fact. Not only is there going to be some mixing, but how many Germanic Americans, German Americans, do we have here? And how many of you speak German? Okay, how many Nordic types And how many of you speak Swedish or Norwegian or Danish? So you see the point there that the culture of the place begins to take over. How many have lutefisk every Christmas? Must be Norwegian.
No, I'm a Finn. I'm completely different.
I knew there'd be a problem if I said Nordic. Are the Finns eat lutefisk too?
It's questionable where the Finns came from. Yes, I have only at Christmas Eve.
Only Christmas Eve. Garrison Keeler says, if it's so darn good, why do we only have it once a year? I don't think that negates the point that if your tradition says that you're someplace 400 years, it means because it indicates that you are accepting pieces of the culture of as your own.
But there is this whole other mythology around being a Jew, which is around separation.
Sure.
So if there's any culture that could make a claim that they stayed separate. I mean, the Jews have always, been there.
And you know where they got that claim from? Maybe from the Egyptians, who also kept themselves separate from everybody else.
Yeah, okay.
You know, part of the reason they're up there in Goshen is because the Egyptians aren't going to mess with shepherds.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So that claim, as distinctive as it is for us today, was not so distinctive in the ancient world.
Okay.
And as you say, there's another tradition. All I'm trying to raise today is that there are several traditions. Mm-hmm. There is not one tradition as to who were the Israelites and later the Judahites, but there are several traditions. Psalm 7 says Cush, Cushi, the Cushite, a Benjaminite.
Right.
He was one of them, and nobody saw any difference.
Yeah.
A classmate of mine from grad school has written an article called The Horses of Cush. It's in the journal Near Eastern Studies from about 1994, I think. And she outlines she and her husband were classmates. She was an Egyptologist, her husband an Assyriologist. And together, he did the Assyriological research and she did the Egyptian research for this, just a 10-page article. Her name is Lisa Heidorn. And she outlines the clear presence in the 8th century of Cushites everywhere in the ancient Near East. There are colonies in Assyria, in Mesopotamia. The biblical evidence is clear. The 8th century, as I already mentioned, is the Ethiopian dynasty. So the actual pharaohs of Egypt were Ethiopians, and this is an interest. It's sort of I'm a very Barthian person, but not Karl Barth. It's Frederick Barth, the Norwegian anthropologist. It seems that at least in Egypt, what made you Egyptian was your acceptance of Egyptian culture and the Egyptians' acceptance of you as one of them. So every pharaoh, male or female, there were five females, stepped into the throne. Put on the double crown, put on the beard, put on Egyptian stuff, and became the personification of Egyptian culture and religion. Didn't matter if they were from the north or from the south, which nome they came from. It matters that they assumed the position, not in the modern urban sense, against the wall while the police searched you. But assumed the position of pharaoh and represented their acts on the walls, the great walls of Karnak and so on, in the form that Egyptians can recognize. And this was the problem with the 18th dynasty. They changed things, and so they're known as the Heretic dynasty. The family of Tutankhamun, Akhenaten, and that whole bunch is known as the Heretic pharaohs because they switched gods and went in a different direction. So, any other questions, observations up to this point?
Well, would the same have held true if there was Cushites all through the region? Would the same have held true of other groups? I mean, was there safe trade that people would move and establish themselves in a place?
I mentioned this yesterday. The movement in the ancient world was much more fluid than we usually give it credit for. part of it is the one of the prevailing stories about Judaism, Judaism, Yahwism, is that it was very separate. Mm-hmm. But then we get all kinds of stories that indicate how it wasn't separate. If you read the story of the conquest, you know, in Joshua, we get this sweeping conquest, and everybody needs to be annihilated. But then you get to Joshua 12, 13, I think, then there's this list of cities that they didn't manage to clean out. And it just happens to be the really big cities. Like Hazor, huge, acres and acres and acres in the north. Jerusalem, you know, took till David got there to take over Jerusalem. Another huge, very popular city. Megiddo, didn't manage to get Megiddo. It's like saying, I conquered the U.S., except for L.A., Chicago, New York, and Miami. yeah, there's a lot of stuff, but there's also a lot of stuff not to be conquered. You just kind of walk in and homestead for a while. So there was a lot of movement, and we've got stuff going back into the third millennium, letters of trade between kings, much more controlled than we understand, nothing like free trade. Well, there is nothing like free trade in this world, is there? very, very much controlled by the powers that be, but a lot of movement, and a lot of movement on the margins. So, the really interesting story I saved to last, Genesis 38, let's look at this together. I'm going to tell the story. You can kind of follow along. This is the story. We're going to do this in another form tomorrow, the day after. We're going to talk about the Levirate law. Basically, the law is that if I marry and I die before giving my wife a child, my brother or another close kinsman is obligated to give her my child. It's not his child. It's my child. You know, to carry forward my line. Judah. Apparently a little embarrassed by what happened in Genesis 37 when Joseph was sold. Nobody quite understands why this story is inserted here, because it's clearly an independent story. We have 37, we start the Joseph story, and then 39, we continue the Joseph story, all the way through 50, basically. But here we have this little insertion, and some people suggested that it's due to being a little miffed with his brothers for doing such a despicable deed. But he wanders off into Canaanite territory. Remember Canaan in this basic myth, basic story about who we are, who the world is, falls into the category with the Africans, the northern Africans. And culturally, the archaeology represents some of them as well. And he marries a local gal, and they have children. Didn't take him 400 years. Yeah. Right away jumped in. And they have three sons, Er, Onan, and Selah. And, they're in the area, and they got to get married. They're growing up, right? So Er marries a local girl. He does something, nobody knows what it is, not mentioned in the story. God doesn't like it, strikes him dead. So Onan, the famous brother who gave us wonderful word, Onanism, and if you don't know what it is, look it up. I'm not going to talk about here. I just say that it has nothing to do with what it talks about in the dictionary, but it has to do with not fulfilling your obligations in a just society to help make society most just. This is his sin in the story. He goes in to perform the task, but withdraws prematurely and winds up abusing repeatedly his sister-in-law. She never has this child. God doesn't like this, strikes Onan dead. By this point, Judah's just a little dubious about what's going on in the tent there with Tamar. And he kind of, the younger says, well, he's not really old enough to marry yet. You go back to your family home, and when he's old enough, we'll send for you. So technically, Tamar is still in the family, but she's gone back to her family of origin to wait for the third son, who is supposed to give her just dessert, which is a child, a male child, who will protect her in this system where widows are otherwise unprotected. What happens there? Time passes. He doesn't call her. He's going down to the sheep shearing festival. She hears that he's going. She's a little miffed that she doesn't have her son yet. So she dresses herself as a prostitute. The father of our holy line turns in to visit the prostitute. She becomes pregnant. He becomes furious that his daughter-in-law, because he doesn't know it was his daughter-in-law, you know, it's sort of like a restoration comedy. becomes pregnant. He calls for her. They're ready to stone her. Well, she was smart. She said, I haven't had any cash. He said, well, give me your staff and your seal, and the signs of your pledge that you'll pay. And the next day, he sends his friend down there, and the friend says, yeah, she's not there. And everybody says, but there's no prostitute that works the street. So they forget about it. Then months later, they hear she's pregnant. They call for her to come up. They're ready to stone her, and she says, yes, I have played the harlot. And when you find the man to whom these things belong, you'll know who the father is. And Judas says, she's a very righteous woman. more just than I. That's how the story ends. So this Canaanite woman who dresses and plays the part of a prostitute to seduce her father-in-law. I'm not recommending this. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying it's in our text. Right? It's part of our story. All kinds of people are make parts of our stories. Spread it. Has twins. One of these twins is regarded as the progenitor, the continuation of the line of Judah, which of course gives us King David, the greatest king that ever lived. King David has Canaanite blood. He has Moabite blood. For those who are still concerned about what kind of blood we have, most of us have red blood. But the Canaanites, at least according to this grouping here at the beginning of the Table of Nations, fall into the group with the Africans mentioned specifically in the Bible. So in the great royal family of Israel, we have African descendancy. If that's not enough to convince you, look at Zephaniah 1:1. I think it's Zephaniah. I don't think these Z guys can hear it. In the Old
Testament.
Yes, please.
The word of the Lord that came to Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of King Josiah, son of Ammon of Judah.
So it's Cushi, Cushite. Son of Gedaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah. We're back in the royal family again, folks. Mm-hmm. This time with the Cushite. So we've got it from the Canaanite side, and we've got it from the Cushite side in the royal family of Israel, in the Judahite line of Israel. How much time do we have left? Oh, time's up. Darn, if we had more time, we'd talk about where the Judahite line goes in Tim's book. Tim, genealogy is in the New Testament.
Yeshua,
that Jewish guy. I think the Gospel of Matthew begins. This is the genealogy of Jesus Christ, son of Abraham, son of David. So that guy, it seems, had some African blood as well.
I have this little explanation. Note for the Judah and Tamar story in the NIV study Bible. It says
The unsavory events of this chapter illustrate the danger that Israel as God's separated people faced if they remained among the Canaanites.
Yeah.
And then look at this. While there were Judah's actions contrasted with those of Joseph in chapter 39, demonstrating the moral superiority of Joseph, to whom it and we just heard how Joseph took an Egyptian wife. This is pretty interesting.
Yeah, but he married into a good family. He married into a high priest family, and not into this, you know, someone who would stoop to play the prostitute on the side of the road. One of the proudest moments. Time's up, so if you need to go, you know, feel free. There won't be nothing that we say now will be on the exam. But one of the proudest moments for me in the past 8 years in Brazil is that one of my students picked up on this idea that Tim and I are playing with here, and wrote an article for our little book, our little journal down there, and the title translates to "Bible helps that don't help." and he went through the Portuguese study Bibles, and I think he dealt with Acts 8 with the Ethiopian eunuch, because the study Bibles, and if you look in your study Bible, it says things like, "My goodness, think of how amazing this is that the first convert to Christianity was an African." Because the people who wrote these commentaries, these study helps, can't get it into their head that, you know, Judaism has been in Africa for a long time, and Christianity got there before it got to Rome. Long before it got to Wittenberg. Or Geneva. Or, you know, Westminster. You know, Canterbury. You know, it went down there early on. Because it had deep roots there, and of course it's going to go there. Of course it's going to follow its tradition, its roots, its lines. And so the student's name is Ezekiel. He heard something that I'd said in a lecture once and then decided that he wanted to follow that up. Because I was talking about it in English, I didn't have time to read the Portuguese study Bible. I don't read study Bibles anymore because they make me too angry. But he decided to take that idea and see what happened with the Portuguese study Bibles, and found that the same thing had happened in South America. That these throwaway comments, these racialized perceptions of the biblical world based on our racialization of the modern world, are just spread out through all the stuff that we do in the seminary, in the religion department classrooms, in the university divinity schools, and in the commentaries that we produce. And I'm just trying to do a little piece that so a few Holdenites will understand that you've got to be really careful when you read the footnotes that are not textual. And even when you read the textual stuff, you've got to think about what the process of editing the text was along the way and who's interested in doing it. So, for me, that's it for today. If there are questions, I'll stay and take questions. But for the rest of you, I've got important things to do. Thanks for your attention up till now, and I hope you find out where we're going to be tomorrow. We'll come back.